From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. A society functions smoothly, in part because its nonpartisan institutions run so reliably, they're downright boring. Well, recently, two federal agencies have become anything but boring. The first, of course, is the United States Postal Service. Postmaster General Louis DeJoy faced 2 days of congressional grilling over changes he's made to American mail delivery. Here's House Oversight Committee Chair Carolyn Maloney.
Whatever the cause of these massive delays, the American people want to go back to the way things were. They don't want these changes. They want them reversed. They don't want anyone messing with the post office, and they certainly don't want it politicized.
That was on Monday. Now, the second agency is the Food and Drug Administration. Last week, President Trump accused the FDA, with no evidence whatsoever, of being rife with deep state operatives seeking to slow down potential new COVID treatments.
You have a lot of people over there that don't want to rush things because they want to do it after November 3rd. And you've heard that one before.
Again, the president made that accusation with no evidence. So what happens to a democratic society? What happens to that society's ability to function when its nonpartisan institutions become so politicized? And can that politicization be reversed? That's what we're going to look at this hour. And let's start with the U.S. Postal Service. Lisa Ryan is a reporter for The Washington Post who covers federal agencies, including the USPS and management of government in the Trump administration. And she joins us from Washington. Lisa, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you so much for having me.
So first of all, I just want to play a moment or two from the congressional testimony that Postmaster General DeJoy gave. This is from yesterday, first of all, before the House, where California Democratic Representative Katie Porter asked DeJoy who ordered the changes to the Postal Service that led to the House's hearings, you know, the removal of sorting machines, the ending of overtime pay, that kind of thing. And here is how DeJoy answered.
There were many, many executives, almost 30,000 executives within the organization. And there are plans that existed prior to my arrival that will continue, that were implemented.
Mr. DeJoy, if you did not order these actions to be taken, please tell the committee the name of who did.
I do not know.
That was yesterday before the House. So, Lisa, did we get more insight into sort of the precipitating cause to the mail slowdown that people have been experiencing over the past several weeks?
Right. So I think Mr. DeJoy is, you know, he's clearly, you know, on the hot seat here. And you know, he both, I think he's parsing, you know, many of the decisions, and he's claiming on the one hand that he takes responsibility for them. On the other hand, he's saying he doesn't. And so what happened was DeJoy said that he, when he came into the Postal Service, he read an audit report by the Postal Service Inspector General, that in recent report that said that the trucks that basically take mail and packages, you know, from the sort of sorting facilities to the mail hubs where eventually, you know, they filter down to the individual mail carriers or on their routes, that those trucks were operating inefficiently and that the trucks were, you know, sometimes waiting too long to collect mail. They were taking trips without any mail on the trucks, and that this was leading to billions of dollars in overtime. So he has acknowledged that he decided that it was very important, because his mission is to right-size the Postal Service, to get these trucks to move more efficiently. The result of this, though, was that all the way down, you know, the line from, you know, what the trucks, you know, role in distributing the packages to and letters to their destination, you know, this has resulted in a domino effect where in many parts of the country you have had delays, and letter carriers were told, you know, if you haven't finished your route, you know, you need to just leave the mail behind for the next day. And this kind of has catapulted the operation into chaos because deliveries have been late. Not all deliveries, but many. And so Mr. DeJoy said that, you know, he has acknowledged that overtime has been a problem, and the Postal Service has a fact sheet that it's distributed to reporters saying that overtime is a problem. But then he said to lawmakers both Friday and yesterday, well, I didn't cut overtime. So it's all very confusing, and I think he is trying to parse things. The other piece is that what he may be referring to when he says, I didn't order these changes, I think what he's saying is that separately, there have been longstanding plans that, and he's right on that, to remove the blue collection boxes in neighborhoods where they are not used all that often. And the previous Postmaster General, we did the same thing. And the same issue is true of sorting machines that, you know, there has been a plan just because of the decline in first class mail over the years to remove these machines. And that he has continued that plan. And I think that's what he's referring to.
Okay, so, but then, the complicating factors here, Lisa, are that the President of the United States himself basically said that slowing down the mail slows down mail-in ballots. And that is what immediately made this sort of a DEFCON level 5 issue, especially for for Democrats here, right?
Yeah.
So did we get any clarity? I know that that DeJoy was asked, like, what kind of contacts has he had with the Trump administration or the Trump campaign in particular around mail-in balloting? Did he get questions around that, or how did he answer them?
He did. So, you know, as you point out, the larger context here is that DeJoy, he comes in with sort of what critics might say is baggage because he is viewed as a partisan off the bat, you know, in a job that traditionally has been held by nonpartisans who, you know, have come up through the Postal Service. You know, the previous, I think, three postmaster generals, you know, started as low-level employees and worked their way up, which sort of kind of shows you that they are probably not partisan. So DeJoy comes in. He's a big donor to Republican causes. You know, he gave $1.2 million to the Trump campaign since 2016, another $1.3 million to the Republican Party. And, you know, that's fine. Nothing wrong with that. It's just that he comes into this job being viewed as a partisan. Now, he also is a logistics czar. He has experience. He ran a big logistics company. So, you know, he's coming in and doing what he was brought in to do, you know, which is to take an agency that has lost money for many years with the decline, you know, of first-class mail on the Internet. And he's trying to eliminate the pockets of inefficiencies. So the problem, though, is that he comes in, makes these changes, and President Trump, I mean, as is well known to, I think, many Americans, you know, does not like mail balloting. He feels that it's going to lead to a fraudulent election. And so, you know, DeJoy comes in, he's making these changes. The president starts tweeting about vote by mail and saying how terrible and fraudulent it is. And then you've just had really just a perfect storm that created, as you said, you know, just has created a crisis. And what DeJoy told lawmakers in both appearances before Congress was that he's a Republican. He's donated to Republican causes, but that he is doing his job, that he is now, the hat he now wears is as the Postmaster General. And he said he is committed to ensuring that the balloting by mail, which as we know is going to be historically high in November because of the virus, committed to ensuring that it goes smoothly, that all the resources that the states need, you know, they will have. In fact, the Board of Governors has established a commission to look into this. That's going to report to Senator Schumer within 2 weeks.
I'm curious, though. So, but was he clear at all on whether or not he has had contacts with or meetings with the president or the Trump re-election campaign about the Postal Service? And the reason why I ask is because I believe New York Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez might have even suggested that lawmakers subpoena DeJoy's USPS calendar see if he has had such meetings.
Right. So the Congresswoman clearly had something up her sleeve that she was interested in. She kept her cards close to her vest. I don't know what she is looking at and what she has. DeJoy said that he met with the president, I think, just to sort of be congratulated, you know, on the job. He said he has not had contact with the Trump campaign. And so, you know, I don't know. This is what he said. There is just so a lot of mistrust of what he's doing. I think it is pretty clear. You know, my colleagues talked to close associates of DeJoy's who said that he has really been frustrated by Trump's, you know, politicization of the vote by mail process, just as DeJoy, you know, is taking over the job. And this is, you know, this is Trump, a habit of Trump's. He tends to do these. But, you know, DeJoy has said that he's trying to do the job. He's taking the job very seriously. And he has said privately to associates that you know, Trump's comments have not helped.
So, you know, Lisa, I'm remembering that we talked to you a couple of months ago when there was another flashpoint of controversy over privatizing the Postal Service. And I remember you saying back then that you really love talking about the USPS because it's such an interesting agency, long history, really fascinating place. So can you just briefly tell me for a couple of seconds what impact you think this politicization is having on the Postal Service?
Well, you know, someone on the Board of Governors I was talking to said, you know, the problem is that perception is reality. So, you know, what they are faced with, the top executives of the Postal Service, is they're faced with a perception that because of everything we've talked about, you know, late mail delivery, which DeJoy, by the way, says that, you know, since he has suspended the cuts, he says, you know, should shortly go back to normal. But I think the problem
Lisa,
is...
Lisa, hang on here for just a second, Lisa. I've got to take a quick break. So when we come back from that break, I want to hear you finish that thought on what the problems actually are. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about what happens when typically nonpartisan federal agencies become politicized and how that has an impact on the smooth functioning of the society that those agencies are meant to serve. I'm joined today by Lisa Ryan. She's a Washington Post reporter who covers federal agencies and the management of government in the Trump administration. She's been reporting on the U.S. Postal Service. And before the break, Lisa, I had asked you about, you know, what impact is this politicization of the USPS having on its ability to do its, you know, its core functions. And you were giving me an answer about what the problem that the Board of Governors sees.
Right. Sure. So I think, you know, the leadership of the Postal Service is now faced with the problem that this perfect storm has created. And that is that the perception, you know, becomes reality. So the perception, whether, you know, you're cynical and you think this was you know, designed to be confusing or not, the perception is that the voting system could be in disarray in November. That may very well not be true. And, you know, the Postmaster General has committed in two congressional hearings to ensuring that ballots are distributed properly, that they are treated as first-class mail, which they have always been. He is committed to that. And, you know, the Democratic leadership of Congress is certainly, you know, this is top of their agenda, and he is clearly, you know, they are holding him accountable. And as we were saying earlier, the Board of Governors now has a committee that it has established to ensure the integrity of the mail. So I think the answer is we don't know. But the problem I think we're facing is that, you know, the mail balloting and the postal services, you know, kind of constitutional role in delivering ballots to Americans is now becoming a Rorschach test, you know, for conservatives who don't like vote by mail, including obviously the president at the top, right, who say, you know, people don't have to give their ID. There's going to be all kinds of just people filling out ballots, multiple ballots who shouldn't be. And then, you know, you have Democrats who say that, you know, ballots are going to arrive late, because the Postal Service has already shown that it has, you know, a partisan at the helm who already has made changes, you know, that have affected delivery. So it's really a tough situation for the Postal Service. And, you know, we do have a few months, so I think we don't know what's going to happen. But the perception on both sides of disaster has really raised just the stakes for this agency.
Yeah, but just to be clear, Lisa, the reality, though, is that there is evidence that the mail delivery has slowed down, though, right? Just to be clear on that, in the past couple of weeks.
Yes, except that DeJoy has said, you know, that because he is freezing the changes in place, so what he says is, you know, he's not going to restore sorting machines that he got rid of. He's not going to, you know, put boxes, you know, collection boxes back. The overtime, I think he's a little bit sketchy on. That was really not clear. You know, he's saying that he's already seeing changes in, you know, seeing the restoration of on-time delivery. And so he has promised that, and we, you know, will, and Congress will be, you know, obviously trying very hard to monitor, you know, what happens here. So that's our job, and that's the job of Congress.
These are things that can and will be checked. Now, on this issue of the perceptions really matter, one of the reasons why they really matter is because that leads to a sense of trust or lack of trust in these very institutions, these very important agencies that help American society continue to run. So that takes us to the second agency I want to talk about today, and that is the Food and Drug Administration. Now, as people know, this weekend, on Sunday, the president announced the FDA's approval of an emergency use authorization for convalescent plasma to be used to treat COVID patients. Now, in that announcement on Sunday, FDA Chief Dr. Stephen Hahn was alongside the president. Hahn repeated claims, the president, I should say, in this announcement, repeated claims that he made earlier that he thinks this EUA, or emergency use authorization, had been delayed for political reasons. The president previously having tweeted about deep state operatives he thinks are in the FDA, tweeted without any evidence, I should underscore. And the president on Sunday implied that the White House pressured the FDA to get the approval for that convalescent plasma through.
I think that there might have been a holdup, but we broke the logjam over the last week, to be honest. I think that there are people in the FDA and actually in your larger department that can see things being held up and wouldn't mind so much. It's my opinion, a very strong opinion, and that's for political reasons.
That's the president on Sunday. Well, joining us now is Nicholas Florco, Washington correspondent for STAT. He covers the intersection of politics and health policy and has been reporting on the FDA. Nicholas, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so first of all, what is the true story about how the use of convalescent plasma got that emergency use authorization?
Well, I don't think we have all of the details yet, but there are some pretty illuminating ones. So news actually broke before this EUA came out that there was a debate within the Trump administration, specifically within the National Institutes of Health and the FDA, over whether there was enough data to support an emergency use authorization, which I should say for listeners is basically like a quasi-approval. You don't need as high of a standard to get an EUA during a pandemic because there's this understanding that treatments need to get out to people quickly. So there was this disagreement. And the New York Times had reported that the NIH had won the day. They had convinced the FDA not to issue this emergency use authorization. That was last week. Then on Saturday, we had the Trump tweet that you already mentioned. And then on Sunday, we had the press conference where Commissioner Stephen Hahn sat idly by as the president chided the FDA and also praised them for getting this out the door. Now, the commissioner has said that the data had been being reviewed for a long time. This wasn't in response to political pressure. The biggest issue here, though, is the message that it sends for people that are looking at this from the outside. I think it's fair to say that people can disagree on whether there is enough data here to support an EUA, but the issue and the optics of hearing that there was a debate and that this was stopped, and then a Trump tweet came out, and then the next day there's a press conference where they don't even take questions about this this disagreement is really troubling, especially for the American public.
Okay, so the questions about the independence of the FDA, will come back to that. But Nicholas, there's also a really huge part here, which you've reported on quite extensively, that in that Sunday press conference, there were claims made by everyone standing up there on the stage that just had no basis in science in terms of the effectiveness of this convalescent plasma, right? So first of all, there's no randomized controlled trials of this plasma. Right. And yet over the weekend, we heard the president and even Dr. Hahn claim that the use of convalescent plasma led to a 35% reduction in mortality for COVID patients. And that number just... scientists and researchers, and even I think at least some of the people associated with the original Mayo Clinic studies on this, were like, where did that number come from? Nobody knows where it came from. So like outrageous claims were made that had no basis in fact.
Exactly. And we saw actually the FDA commissioner, after countless criticisms, even from former FDA commissioners, so his closest colleague, saying, you need to issue a correction here. He finally did that yesterday night and went on CBS this morning to try to explain it more. But the damage has really been done here. I mean, that was a sort of jaw-dropping statistic to hear from the FDA commissioner. And there was really prompt calls to have him retract that and to explain the limits here. Because like I said, you can have a discussion about whether this EUA was warranted, but the public has come to expect the FDA commissioner to have a reasonable conversation with the American public about what we know and what we don't know about a treatment before issuing these EUAs, not just singing its praises. I think if Commissioner Hahn was more honest to the American people during that press conference, then we probably wouldn't be having this conversation.
I saw in Hahn's Twitter thread yesterday about it, he tried to fudge it, saying he should have been clear about the difference between relative versus absolute risk, but I still don't know how that 35% number comes out of that distinction there. But the more important thing is what you're pointing out, that isn't it highly unusual to begin with for the president of the United States to stand next to the FDA commissioner to make an announcement about an EUA. And simultaneously, I'm looking at the FDA's own news release about the convalescent plasma, and it's got this big, bold headline at the top: FDA issues emergency use authorization for convalescent plasma as potential promising COVID-19 treatment. Another achievement in administration's fight against pandemic. Have we ever seen that kind of language in an FDA press release, even?
I would probably say no. I mean, there's always this dance between the FDA wanting to celebrate achievements, meaning celebrate new treatments coming to market, and also appearing as an impartial regulator. They often have this awkward dance they have to do between being the ones who are actually regulating and are supposed to be hard on industry and cheering on industry when new treatments come to market. And we've especially seen a lot of the cheering on during the pandemic. I mean, it's definitely accelerated. I would say that there's definitely been times before where folks have looked at the FDA's statements on treatments being approved and say, and maybe they would want them to be more impartial, but this is definitely a new level, I would say.
Mm. Yeah, and also just, to my mind, the cheering on of industry versus the cheering on, or in addition to the cheering on of advancements that are good for the health and safety of the American people, understandable, but it's the emphasis of the administration's fight against the pandemic, so the cheering on of the White House achievement, which seems kind of unusual to me here. And that leads to something else that you've been reporting on, which is, even prior to this, prior to what happened this weekend, have there been concerns amongst employees at the FDA about the agency's independence?
Well, I think there's been concerns by the informed public writ large. I mean, this is a concern that's always existed within the FDA, but it's really been accelerated during the Trump administration. So the clearest example I can point to is that most of the former FDA commissioners going back administrations, all the way back to the George W. Bush administration, have, after they've finished their tenure as commissioner, signed on to these letters calling for the FDA to become an independent agency, because they've said that all of them, at some point in their careers, have been under pressure either from the Department of Health and Human Services, which is the department above the FDA, or from the White House over certain issues that they're regulating. And they say that's bad for public health. And that's happened with Republican and it's happened with Democratic administrations. David Kessler, he was a commissioner during the Bill Clinton administration. He's been very vocal that he struggled with the Clintons during his quest to regulate tobacco. So these sorts of things have always happened. The big difference here, though, is that we've never seen them play out so clearly in public. Informed folks that follow the FDA know that it's an open secret that there is always politics that weigh in on FDA decisions, but we've never seen it to the point where the president is openly pressuring the FDA to do something, and that leads to a big issue of public confidence that we haven't had before.
Right. So this is exactly what Lisa was telling us about a couple of minutes ago, right, about the U.S. Postal Service, that perceptions really matter here because that can have an impact on the public's trust in the FDA. Is there a concern about that?
Yeah, and I think it's an even bigger concern with the FDA because we know that a vaccine is coming down the pike for coronavirus, and the public is already, a large portion of the public is already vaccine skeptic. There was a poll that came out that roughly only 50% of people would feel comfortable getting a coronavirus vaccine. And so that's really concerning because we need the public to be able to trust the FDA will only approve a vaccine for coronavirus that is both safe and effective. And the folks with inside the FDA, the civil servants, are clearly committed to that. But it's the public perception that this is being rushed forward for President Trump for an election win that could really have disastrous impacts on public health.
Hmm. So, Lisa, do you see parallels here between what these two agencies are experiencing right now?
Yeah, absolutely. And Nicholas, that was just fascinating. This idea that he was talking about the FDA, that, you know, we've always had in this case a debate, you know, for the FDA between private industry and government and those tensions, but that they're sort of spilling into the public now. And at the Postal Service, I mean, we've kind of had that in that there's long been suspicion, you know, among Democrats, although that's not really at play in this crisis, but, you know, that Republicans want to privatize the Postal Service. And in this case, it's sort of a question of, well, you know, the Postal Service's financial picture, which, you know, has been bad for a decade, you know, the question is sort of, are people jockeying to take advantage of that? And so, you know, we've had, you know, the president doesn't like Amazon and he's, you know, wanted to force the Postal Service to raise package prices on Amazon. And so in the same way, Trump has certainly politicized the agency. Mm-hmm.
Well, so Nicholas, can I turn back to you for a second here? Because I really think it's important that this theme that both of you have brought up about how perceptions really matter here. But I also want to just check on sort of realities. I heard you say a minute ago that we've had the executive branch under various administrations really try to perhaps even overreach in terms of the FDA itself. But have the processes to buffer that overreach, I presume they've been effective in the past. And are those, is that buffering capacity to maintain the trustworthiness of the FDA, is that still as robust as it needs to be, or is that too breaking down?
So it's the big question. I mean, so really this comes down to the FDA commissioner, because typically it's the job of the FDA commissioner to protect the career level staff at the FDA from this sort of political pressure. That's why when you talk about things like David Kessler fighting with the Clintons over tobacco, that's because that was happening in the Oval Office. This is happening in full display of all the FDA staff. They can read President Trump's tweets too. And so the pressure clearly is trickling down in a way that it hadn't previously. That being said, there are regulators at the FDA who are not political appointees who have made it very clear that they want to uphold the FDA's stringent approval standards. So the person where the buck pretty much stops for vaccines is a scientist named Peter Marks. He leads the FDA's Biologics Center. And he has said publicly in interviews that if he was asked to approve an unsafe vaccine for coronavirus, that he would resign. So there are still some firewalls here. There are still people within the FDA that are trying to protect the career civil servants from political pressure. But we have seen more political pressure weighing down on sort of the rank and file in the FDA than we have before.
Well, Nicholas Florco with STAT and Lisa Ryan with The Washington Post, thank you both so very much. We'll be back with more. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow, it will be day three of the Republican National Convention, and we will be talking about Vice President Mike Pence, about his record, his accomplishments, his relationship with President Donald Trump in this first Trump administration. So we want to know, what are your questions about Vice President Pence? What do you think of the work he has done as the number two in the Trump administration? Your opinion on his value as a bridge to the white evangelical community for President Trump. And what do you think Pence, Vice President Pence, brings to this election cycle as President Trump seeks re-election in 2020? Call us at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. That's for tomorrow's show. Today, we are talking about the USPS and the FDA and how the politicization of usually nonpartisan federal agencies, the impact that that has on those agencies' very ability to serve the American people. Before the break, we heard from two deeply informed reporters who have been following the Postal Service and the FDA. And joining us now from Chicago is Susan Stokes. She's a professor of political science and director of the Chicago Center on Democracy at the University of Chicago and co-director of Bright Line Watch, an academic initiative that monitors democratic practices in the U.S. and seeks to call attention to threats to American democracy. Professor Stokes, welcome to you.
Thank you, Meghna. It's great to be here.
So first of all, I always like to sort of check my presumptions or even theses that I bring to the table here for these On Point conversations. And as you probably heard at the very beginning of the hour, I made an assertion that the politicization of nonpartisan agencies in any democratic society really inhibits their ability to function and serve that very society. And that ostensibly has an impact on us all. Just check me on that thesis. Would you agree or disagree?
I do agree. And, you know, there's an inherent tension in sort of the public bureaucracy and executive branches in all countries between, you know, they're there to execute the law, think that they have to get things done, but they're led by a political actor, a prime minister or a president. And the so it's not surprising that there will be a kind of tension or a little bit of a push and pull between the sort of the more technical or more sort of service oriented goals of the agencies and the goals, which are at the end of the day, policy and also political of the executives who lead those branches. There are ways in which one designs agencies so that they get more insulated, more walled off from executive manipulation. But it's an inherent tension. I think what we're seeing now that is unusual in the U.S. context and certainly internationally in advanced democracies is a different kind of politicization of these agencies, which is that they are being brought to bear so closely on a approximate election. So there's often a concern about private interests getting involved in, drug trials and so forth, the FDA. There's been a longstanding ideological conflict over the post office, which your previous guest mentioned, with many Republicans being in favor of privatization, Democrats seeing it more as a kind of public service, almost a public utility. And that's a kind of ideological clash. But what we're seeing now is a kind of a politicization of the post office related not to a kind of ideological difference, but to a very naked electoral concern. Mm-hmm. So that's I think different. That's new. That's unusual.
So it seems that you would agree that there are red flags then in terms of what's happening to the Postal Service and the FDA, that these are worthy of examination, and it's not just sort of politics as usual.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that Lisa, your previous guest, put it very well, that there with the post office, there's, you know, there are kind of competing narratives of what's happened, but there's such a lack of transparency that it's very difficult for, you know, well-meaning citizens, those of us out here who are kind of consuming the discourses, these the competing narratives and the news, to really feel that we understand what's happened. And so the postmaster says in hearings that that many of these plans were underway and that he's committed to mail-in balloting working smoothly. But the lack of transparency means that we can't be confident of that, and we shouldn't be, because the systems aren't in place to make sure that we really know what the intentions are. And furthermore, mm-hmm. as you pointed out, you have the White House, the president, constantly a kind of counter narrative, even to that of the postmaster, saying, you know, you can't trust mail-in balloting, you can't trust elections via the mail, that they'll be full of fraud, and that it strikes me that if that were the concern, if you were, you know, put yourself in the position of a president an election is coming up. You have a pandemic. A lot of people are not well advised to go vote in person or won't want to, and you have some concerns about the efficacy and you know, vulnerability to fraud, perhaps of mail-in balloting. You would quietly go talk to various state level officials. You would be talking to all kinds of people in the postal office to try to anticipate those problems and make sure that they don't happen. You would not be going to the public day after day on Twitter or in press conferences, making very strong statements that there will be fraud.
Mm-hmm. So there's a lot here that I want to dig into with you. Let's start with this, because both Nicholas and Lisa brought this up about perception. Right. And the importance of a positive public perception of the functioning of these agencies, because the public's trust in these agencies is paramount. And so what impact does it have on an institution in a democratically functioning society where when the president himself is saying things? I'll use the FDA as an example, that deep state comment. That are not true, and B are designed, whether by intent or by accident, to make people begin to doubt the motives of the very regulators who are charged with assuring the safety of the American people. I mean, certainly that degrades the public trust in these agencies. And what impact does that have on sort of the functioning of our democracy?
the public trust is a very delicate tissue that once it's torn is hard to put back together. I think many of us who study democratic erosion around the world and kind of threats to democracy in the United States and elsewhere are really concerned not just about the short term, which we are very concerned about, but the long term impact of the kind of loss of trust in public institutions that we've seen happen in the last several years. So Brightline Watch, the organization that I'm part of, we conduct surveys at regular intervals, both among experts and among the general public. And we ask them, first of all, what aspects of democracy do they think are most important? What dimensions of democracy matter the most? And then how is the U.S. democracy performing? And what we find consistently is that at the very top are, in terms of importance, are dimensions related to elections, free and fair elections, elections in which citizens have fair access to ballots. That's at the very top. Also very important are issues like that the authority of the executive is effectively limited by in a kind of checks and balances system, by the legislative branch, by the courts. That investigations into wrongdoing by public officials are sealed off from influence. And we have seen a decline in confidence, both among experts and in the general public, about those very important aspects of democracy. And as I was saying, that one of the things that is of great concern is not just what impact that will have in November, but what impact that will have going forward. You know, it could be a long time before that public trust is restored, and it could be, a kind of infinite horizon for some subsets of our population before there's before trust is restored. So the narrative of the deep state is basically sort of saying that the politicization of these public institutions, departments, and so forth, agencies is already there. It's already happened, and we're just trying to, you know, kind of fight against it or do this, play the same game, and that's not accurate. So those are problems that will persist potentially for quite a long time.
So this is one of the things about sort of relentless norm shattering that our system of governance has been undergoing for the past several years that most concerns me in the long run, and that is, like, when you shatter norms, you also, as you're pointing out, Professor, you shatter the public trust in the institutions that used to operate within those norms, and that long term effect, basically, we're talking about weakening. Weakening our society. So what are, I mean, this is almost kind of like a sausage making question. What are the ways in which these institutions can actually be strengthened, you know, in this new environment that we have? And the reason why I ask is because, again, I'm thinking back to what Lisa told us about the USPS and what Nicholas told us about the FDA. And one of the things that they pointed to, both of them, was, well, you know, both of these agencies have leaders. There are commissioners in charge here. Of course, in the case of Postmaster General DeJoy, he's a well-known high money donor, which raises a lot of questions in the minds of Americans. But I guess what I'm saying is like, are those traditional buffers enough anymore? And how do we strengthen those buffers?
I think there is a long list of things that we thought were either protected by statute or constitution or by such, you know, deeply historical practice that they were inviolable, that turned out to be very violable, I should say, in the past few years. And I think it's going to be incumbent on the political leadership in various parts of the government and at the state level and local levels as well to think about ways in which those things that are really more norm-based than we realized maybe get, you know, written into law. You will never be able to completely stop an ambitious politician from bending rules and mm-hmm. from skirting around norms. But, you know, there has to be a long list. Now, the Postal Service is a great example. The Postmaster General isn't appointed by the president, and he or she is not a cabinet member. Right. They're chosen by a Board of Governors, and there are seats on that Board of Governors reserved for members of both parties. Now, what happened in and then the candidates are nominated by the president for those positions are put forward by the president, confirmed by the Senate. So it institutionally it looks like it's a way of insulating the postmaster, the leadership of the post office from direct political influence. It turns out that you can get around that, and mm-hmm. Treasury Secretary Mnuchin played a very, very important role in getting around that appointment process, so that we did get, as was noted earlier in your show, someone who was a party donor and had related, professional experience, but not exactly the right kind of professional experience, and who has very close ties to the president. And so, how do we then do? Do we then at some future point kind of change that system, or do we just try to reinforce and shine more light of transparency on the way that instances in which it's abused? Those norms are going to have to be, those are not even just norms. Those are actual rules that we're just going to have to take a long look and see how do we strengthen those things. And there's a whole host of issues. It's not just the post office, not just the FDA. It's also courts, and it's also, elections. I think many experts in democracy, academic experts, are really concerned and have been for a long time about election administration in the United States. Mm-hmm. We're a great country. We have great governing structures. We have a terrible election administration system, one of the worst on the planet, to be honest.
Well, we have basically just a minute and a half left to go. I wonder if in that time, could you fit in an example of elsewhere? I mean, internationally, where there's a system that works better that we could learn from?
Oh, pick any country. It's very likely to work better. I'll just tell you a quick anecdote. In 2006, I was in Mexico at the Federal Elections Institute for a conference, and a young man pulled me aside and said, "You know what? We just did this redistricting of the whole country. Can I show you what happened?" And he pulls out basically a laptop, and they did it by algorithm. He basically pushed a button and they redistricted Mexico. Now Mexico was just coming out of a long, seven decades long period of electoral autocracy with all kinds of shenanigans and, dead people voting and so on and so forth. And yet there they were in 2006 with a far superior system of redistricting than what we have. And that's just, that's just one piece of our election administration. There's all kinds of issues related to, re-registration, redistricting, issues related to ballot access, the ease of voting. Most democracies hold their elections on Sundays or on holidays. Mm-hmm. And we've had many proposals in the past to improve the system. If I could wave a magic wand and change one thing in the United States, it would be to improve election administration.
Well, Susan Stokes is a professor of political science at the University of Chicago and co-director of Bright Line Watch. Professor Stokes, thank you so very much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And my big takeaway from the professor is it's not good enough to rely on normative practices if there's a value in terms of how these institutions operate that Americans really want to see made permanent. You got to codify it into law. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.